I've been looking forward to this one for a while. And I guess it was probably, man, maybe a year and a half. We did this, I know we did one on the phone with you and Dan. We did one in studio. But now, update time, new stuff. Very pleased to be joined by Clint Malarchuk. I said before the break, if there's a guy that could be labeled a survivor, I guess that's you, because of, and we'll walk through it, but the hurdles and events that have happened in your life, it really is miraculous that I'm sitting here talking to you right
before
now.
Before we even get into that, Rhett actually looks human.
Yeah?
Well, yeah, he's cleaned up a bit. You guys are working on him or what?
Well, he went to Saskatoon last week for the hometown hockey thing, so we got a shave and a haircut.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
A
week ago, he's actually looking pretty good.
Yeah, a week ago today, yeah. You think he should have been lying out there on that park?
Oh, yeah, I've seen him.
Yeah, you're familiar. Yeah,
we did this show from a show home, like, what was it, a month and a half ago, boom?
Yeah.
And he walked in to come join the show at 7, as he always does, and excuse me, can we help you? Like, yeah, what's this straggler doing here?
Yeah, yeah, with the trench coat and the paper bag with a bottle
in it. Yeah, they were a little unsure.
Yeah.
So you have, you're an author.
Yeah, how about that?
Look at you.
Yeah, no kidding. I clean up too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I know that similarly, a lot of when athletes or whomever tells their story, they'll get the help of a writer or someone who's accomplished in writing. And you've done that with Dan Robson, who's actually a guy that works with Sportsnet. I know we talked to you two at the same time because he put together the article for Sportsnet magazine. And I think it rocked a lot of people to hear even just a little bit of what you've gone through. And since then, I got to wonder if maybe your life's changed a little bit, even from that article coming out and now finding yourself with a book.
Well, the article, you know, doing the book, first of all, you know, you're bearing your soul. It's an autobiography, and I wanted to be really open, really honest, get it all out there. And how do you do that with somebody you don't really know? Well, he wrote that article, and I kind of said, hey, if I'm going to talk about this stuff, I got to, you know, I'm vulnerable. I got to trust you, you know, and you did a really good job. So that's how I kind of hired Dan.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had a good way of writing and everything. He did a great job. I mean, really, he actually made me sound fairly smart in the book, you know.
That's an accomplishment.
Yeah, no kidding, right there. So, you know, that's how we went forward with it. And, you know, we became very close because, you know, I dropped a tear or two talking about some of this stuff in front of Dan, and you know, he was great. He was like, do you need a minute? You know, do you want to talk about this some other time? You know, he was very compassionate. So that's why the book, I think, we were able to get that stuff out, because he had a good way about him.
I often wonder, when there is a book of this nature, which it is very, if you want to call it graphic, but it's very real. There was no holding back. And I often wonder if it's on the guy writing it to try and pull stuff more out of the storyteller, or if this for you, what was it? Were you just,
he never pushed me. He knew I wanted to get it out, but he was very, like I said, compassionate about it. He was like, you know, we got to talk about this. Are you ready to, you know, and we would take our time, and sometimes we jump ahead and come back to the hard stuff, the real raw stuff. And, you know, like I said, I had to have somebody I could trust and be that vulnerable in front of. And he was really good about it, you know, just the way he did it. And then the way he wrote it, he was able to catch my mood, catch the angst of it all, and put it in a good text.
Clint Malarchuk, our guest, the book is called The Crazy Game, available now, and it's must-read stuff. Let's, without giving away the book, let's go back, I guess, to kind of your childhood, as you're thinking maybe hockey can be a profession. I guess take us through your teenage years and your pursuit of the NHL.
Well, I think early on I struggled. I didn't feel normal as a kid. I felt anxious all the time. I was hospitalized at a young age for severe anxiety. And back then they really didn't know what to do with me. You know, what's wrong, kid? Yeah. And
is there any way to explain to people what that feels like for someone that's never really dealt with anxiety? Is there any way to kind of describe what that feeling might be?
Well, you know, it's like a panic, and it is a panic. It's a panic attack that you can't, for me, I couldn't put my thoughts, you know, complete my thoughts. They would race over and over, and I couldn't change my mind to think about something else or anything like that. And your anxiety level would just increase.
Yeah.
But, you know, with the OCD, you know, I was so driven, you know, my dream was the NHL. So I really trained hard. I mean, from 12 years old, I was doing, you know, workouts. And, you know, 12 years old, you're, especially back in that day, I mean, even the pros weren't working out like I was.
Sure,
and so it helped me get to the NHL. I give OCD a lot of credit for getting me there.
Weird way, right? Yeah.
But in a weird way. And at the end of it, it was also my downfall and you know, ruined my career, but it got worse.
I remember it, not to date you or I, but I was young at the time when there was this incident in hockey. And going back then, there was no internet and the games weren't on television. And all I remember is seeing the clip from a Buffalo Sabre game where something happened on the ice and the announcers are like, don't show it, turn the camera away, we don't need to see this. And we saw very little of it, but you were in net. And it was catastrophic as a skate blade comes up and clips your carotid artery. I guess, is there any way to walk? What do you remember about that instant? Because it has been some time now.
Yeah. And it's still very vivid. It's still in slow motion in my brain. And the incident itself was very, you know, you see it a million times in a hockey game and a guy crashing the net and gets, you know, ends up feet first and I'm coming across in my butterfly and cut my jugular vein when the skate came up. So that part is, you know, very typical. It's the part after that where the blood at first, the first cut, when I, you know, first realized I was cut, it, you know, it was squirting 6 feet in front of me with the pressure of my, of the adrenaline and heartbeat. And I knew there was something major there, that I had minutes to live. And I really thought, I'm done.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got off the ice. People give me credit for skating off the ice. Well, really, I wanted to get off the ice because I thought I was dying. I didn't want my mom to see me on TV, you know, her son dying, bleeding out on TV. So that was my main motivation. But I really did think I was going to die. So thus the trauma.
Yeah. And I remember watching that now. It's the other guy, the players on the ice standing in shock. Ordinarily, when you see someone in distress, you rush to their aid and you help. That was so over the top and so amazing isn't the right word. I almost don't, what do you do? I do give you credit for getting up and getting off the ice, knowing how serious it was. And then, like you say, the trauma, to hear that it's still in slow motion, I don't know how you live with that. And obviously it's a big part of the book.
I did have nightmares for a long time after that, vivid. And, you know, I always describe how, you know, you watch the movie and the actors, he's having a dream and then all of a sudden they flash and he's sitting straight up in bed and he's sweating and panting, you know, Hollywood stuff. And that was me. And it was, you know, that I just sit straight up in bed and just be horrified. And those nightmares were for quite some time.
Yeah.
Quite a while.
So you survive it. It becomes a great story. How is it?
Why was it a great story?
Well, because
I came back so quick.
Well, but that's the thing. Yeah. It's a great story that, you know what? They saved his life. Clint Mularchuk has lived to live another day, let alone play.
Yeah.
How did it come to be? Because again, I said, I don't know in today's day and age with multiple camera angles and we've got talk radio, sports networks, all of this. I can't imagine the outcry if somebody suffered that injury and then 10 days later was back on the ice. Is that your decision? Is it their decision? How do you get back in gear a week and a half later?
For me, I just want, you know, because everybody, you know, it's that mentality, the jock mentality, the tough guy thing. You know, I got to get back and prove to the world and myself that I can come back and play. And that was my mindset. Counseling was never brought up. I never thought of it. And basically physically, you know, it wasn't that hard. I was weak from the loss of blood to play again that quick. But other than that, you know, the physical impact wasn't like I blew out my knee or anything.
Yeah.
And not realizing the psychological damage that was, you know, done and probably kept continuing to digress, you know, that wasn't addressed, wasn't even thought of.
It's funny because there are a lot of people, you hear their stories, not exactly, but similar stories, people who have had something traumatic happen in their life, and there was never any thought of grief counseling.
Right.
Any kind of counseling, okay, well, just, you better? Okay, yeah. Then on you
on
go.
On you go, yeah.
And there's just no way for people to appreciate the mental distress that some people go through. And it's great that it's changed. I know that's a big part of why.
Richard Zednick had counseling. His family had counseling. His teammates had counseling. That was, what, 4 or 5 years ago now?
Yeah.
You know,
well, more than that, yeah.
That's how far we've come.
Yeah.
And when I read that, I was going,
Where was that?
Yeah.
So you're back on the ice. Clearly not well in your mind and not mentally, I don't want, mentally stable. Where were you at this point? I guess kind of describe where you were at.
When I came back it was near the end of the season. So I think I finished, you know, I was kind of a cult hero because of coming back so quick in Buffalo, you know, it was like, wow. And I, you know, I kind of rode that adrenaline and that praise, I think, and that got me through. I didn't, it wasn't like, okay, you know, you're damaged. Those thoughts didn't even occur to me. You know, it wasn't until later in life that I looked back and I went, well, you know what? I really spiraled after that accident. If I was predisposed, which I was, to OCD and anxiety, depression, but somewhat manageable. I mean, I hit it well. I hit it really well. No one knew. But that accident, trauma in itself, I learned later, really looking back, I spiraled.
Well, and at the same time, there's only so much a person can take, like you say, between depression, OCD, anxiety, now trauma. Only human. It's going to take you down at some point.
Well, yeah, but you know, at the time I didn't realize it. You know, it was that happened in 89. It was 2008 when I finally got diagnosed with PTSD. And, you know, I was defiant over that. Are you kidding me? I came back. I manned up. You know, that I wouldn't own that one. You know, I had enough, I had enough labels on me, and I did not want to say, because it was almost saying I was weak.
Now, PTSD.
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah. I just, for people that may not be aware. So how do you get diagnosed? And why did it take so long?
Well, how I got diagnosed was, you know, I finally got, you know, help, medication, you know, probably 3 years after the accident in Buffalo.
Yeah.
And I did really, really well for a long time, just with the medication, basically. I had no real counseling about that injury or anything like that. And then I started to spiral down again. And it led to the real dark, dark depression and anxiety. And that's when I tried to shoot myself. And, you know, the bullet obviously is stuck in my head and it didn't kill me. And then I went to a treatment facility after I came out of, you know, intensive care in a coma and all that. They sent me to a treatment facility. I was in there 6 months. And the first 2 months, I was just in total denial of this PTSD. Nope. You know, I came back quick. I was a man. And then I realized that after, you know, continued therapy and harping on it, I looked into it. And the counselor asked me, well, what was your life like after? Mm-hmm. And that's when I went, oh, my. You know what I did? That's when things really started to go downhill for me. And so then I owned it. I owned up to, you know, okay, you can throw that one into the box too. You know, I got all these other ones. You can add that one. And I started to work through it, you know. With help.
Clint Malarchuk, our guest. The book is The Crazy Game. It is a remarkable story. I know it's difficult. I do want to bring you back, like you say, the shooting attempt, the suicide attempt. Now looking back, can you recognize where you were more or less mentally then? Was it how premeditated was it? Were you contemplating this, or was it just one of those things where you're so deep in depression and in that spiral? It's like, you know what? Today's an awful day. I'm just done.
Well, I didn't leave a suicide note. I didn't intend to shoot myself that day or anything. I did. I didn't want to live with where I was. You know, I would ask God's, you know, either take this pain from me or take me. And it was a very impulsive action when I pulled the trigger. I was shooting, and I rabbits and tin cans. I didn't even know if the gun was still loaded when I did it. And so, yes, I was in a really depressed state and very, very anxious, almost hyper anxious, and then just boom, crash into depression. And my mind, you know, you don't want to stigmatize mental illness with that word crazy, but I felt crazy. You know, who can define it? I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's what I thought I was. Because
just out of control of yourself.
Out of control of my thinking. I couldn't complete thoughts. I was stuck in a racing mode in my brain, and nothing I could do. And I was self-medicating because it did help. For a while, you know, the booze would take a little bit of that anxiety away, but then it would come back and you add more booze. You come back, and before you know it, the booze isn't helping either.
Yeah.
But
so, and I know it'll be in graphic detail in the book.
Oh, it's very graphic. It's very open. It's very honest. My wife went through hell with me on that, you know, and I was a very violent, mean, acting out in anger. And, you know, she saw that part of me and hung in there. And so she suffered her own trauma, you know, and she was there when I shot myself. So her story in the book is remarkable too.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a lot of people are affected with mental illness, but there's probably more that they're affected with living with a loved one or know somebody. And it's what do I do? What can I do? And for them, it's their living hell as well.
For some, writing a book like this, I would think, is therapeutic.
No.
For others, it can just be a painful reminder.
I went through
reminder.
The therapy. Yeah. I went through the counseling. And you know, I was in that treatment center 6 months and with real intensive therapy, a lot of tears, a lot of anger, a lot of just working through this stuff. And you think you've put it behind you, and then you start to put it on paper and talk about it again. And you know what? You know, you have to relive it in your head, and it just stirred everything right up again. It was awful. I hated writing the book. I did. You know, the funny stories, the hockey stories and the humor that was in there, that was fine. But, you know, what was going to make the book real and honest was where I was in depression and where I was with the anxiety and OCD. That's what we had to dig into, because that's what, you know, was what I really, what my life was like. So I had to go there, and it was hard. It was really, really hard. I didn't like doing that part at all.
How close did you come to packing in the project? Just realizing that this is
no, I didn't, because you know, we go into it, and like I said, Dan Robson, the co-writer, was really good about it with me. He realized it was so hard. You know, I mean, we're grown men, and he has to sit there and watch me weep telling these stories, and we bonded through that. And I don't think I ever, but I procrastinated many times.
Yeah.
Procrastinate, and then I started to drink to help me talk about it and get through it, and you know, again, then you're into your relapse. So
yeah,
you know,
that, and that was not actually that long ago, right? All of this,
yeah, last spring.
It's a frustrating thing for people that deal with it. Like you say, you think I've won, I'm, you know, the medication's working, I'm in a great spot, I've won this battle, and then it just happens one day. It's like,
how did I end up back here? Exactly. That's a great way to put it. And, but you know, you do learn, you know, it's like that graph, it's going up, you're getting better, you're getting, there's ups and downs, and then you kind of peak and you're doing really good. And then you bang, the graph, you know, dives down, that line goes down. And, every time I think you learn, like that bottom was not as bad as other bottoms.
Yeah.
And I knew immediately what I had to do to get well, and did it. And now you've learned that you have to even be more diligent in your recovery and healing and everything that goes into it. And, you know, my wife gives me the time that I need to take care of me now. I can put up barriers and still hard for me to say no to some things, you know, because I'm passionate about getting this word out and helping. But I do have to take care of me now, and I have to take the time. Some days are really good for me, easy. Other days, it's hard. It's really hard, and that's when I have to not only with the medication, but there's tools that I have to use. I have to take time to sit back. And for me, it really, I have to be in touch with my emotions. If I'm starting to feel depressed or anxious, I have to kind of take a step back and realize where's my thoughts right now? What's triggering? What's going on? And take the remedy that I need to do to get grounded, to stay in balance.
And it's not like you can take, you know, prick your finger and test your blood. It's like, okay, so how's my depression and anxiety? It's a little bit down.
You know what? Like a diabetic for me, I have to tell people that, you know, I have a chemical imbalance of the brain. I don't produce enough serotonin. What is a diabetic? It's a chemical imbalance with insulin. So it's as much of a physical problem as it is a mental, but the problem with mental illness I'm not sure I like that term, but call it, it affects our emotions. It affects our state of being. So you start to get that mental part and it really, it's a physical abnormality or dysfunction of the body.
I've talked to people who are leery or apprehensive about taking medication for, like you say, serotonin whatever the case may be, because they feel like it's going to maybe change who they are.
Right.
When in fact, it's the chemicals that are not being produced that have already drastically changed who you are.
It's a normalization of the chemical. You know, you help produce more of what you should be producing naturally.
Yeah.
So really, there should be no fear in that. I prayed for so long years before when, you know, that I wish there was a pill that I could take, just make this go away.
Yeah.
And really now years later, there is medication that you can take and it helps, helps normalize you.
And there's a lot of them. We have a lot of guys, and whenever we talk to Theo Fleury or Sheldon Kennedy, or because these stories do come up, and I love having conversations like this. It's remarkable how many people will just contact, whether it's Twitter, email, or say, hey, I really appreciate that. I'm maybe going through something similar.
Right. Yeah.
And I tried medication. I tried this and, you know, it just doesn't work. You have to keep trying. Maybe it's a combination.
Well,
of pills.
With these pills too. Sometimes it's a combination, but with the real struggle is it's almost a 6 week period where you're going to know whether one medication is helping you or not. And if it doesn't, then you got to go another 6 weeks on another medication. So that part is very frustrating, but well worth it once you get the right pill and dosage, right medication and dosage, it's well worth it. A week before the book was released, I went through a touch of anxiety and depression because I was like, oh boy, what's going to, you know, I forgot about the Brian Burke blurb on the jacket and Kelly Rudy and the other people that, you know, read the book and put a blurb on the book jacket. I forgot all about that until later. But it was the first time I was a little bit grateful for a touch of that, nowhere near the depths I've been, but that touch of that depression and anxiety, because it motivated me to, you know what, why did you write this dang thing? You know, it's to help people. And the feedback, like you said, people, the emails and the even from the media that, you know, said I couldn't put the book down. Will you get books? And we kind of have to skim them because we're going to talk to them, you know, and they get so many books and they're all like, I read the whole thing. And for me, that now I'm getting kind of like, I guess you'd say a little bit of the reward of all that pain going through writing it, because the feedback is great. And there's people that have been great just saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. So that makes it worthwhile. It really does.
And I did want to ask you, you had said that you didn't enjoy writing the book. Are you proud of it now that it's done?
Yeah, very proud. I'm proud of the degree and depth that we went in on. There's a part in the book where I'm a SOB. I'm a mean, violent, and my wife saw it and she lived with it and I wasn't very nice to her. You know, I was honest about that, but I also am honest that it wasn't me. It was the sickness. You know, I'm actually a pretty good guy, but at that time I was acting out in a very, very bad way. And I go into detail on that, knowing that it's not a weakness, it's a sickness. And that allowed me to kind of open up as well. But you know, yeah, I mean, it's an open book, so to speak. I mean, it's very graphic and detailed, and I share everything.
I wonder how difficult it was going back to work in the most competitive environment on earth, going back in as a hockey a goaltending coach.
Right.
Because you know as well as anyone, the mood on a bus, on a plane, in a locker room is completely affected by what's on the scoreboard. And meanwhile, you're trying to write a book. And as you say, you still have these demons you have to battle. How tough was it, has it been those last few years?
Yeah, you know, tough, but... It wasn't the hockey that was just the book itself. You know, that was the hard part. The hockey part was almost good. I can get away from the book project. You know, I don't have to think about all that stuff. So just like when I was a kid with dealing with the anxiety and everything, when I was at the outdoor rinks and going skating, doing all that stuff, as soon as I started walking home at 10 o'clock at night when they kicked me off, you know, and I got school the next day, the anxiety would creep back in. By the time I opened the door, I was back to severe depression, anxiety, and part of that was the home life too, but it was real in my body and real in my mind. So hockey's always been kind of a little bit of a escape, even with all the pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah, pressure does magnify these symptoms in me, but it's almost a deterrent type of pressure. If, you know, especially when I was doing the book, writing the book, it was little bit of, okay, I don't have to think about the book and my problems that I'm going to put in the book.
Chatting with Clint Malarchuk, former NHL goaltender, goaltending coach. The book is called The Crazy Game. I guarantee you there's some guys out there right now that are either sitting in their car waiting to go in somewhere, or they're at work with the earbuds in. I've had those emails
I was listening to you on the radio and I had to stay in the car. I'm going to be late, but I don't care. I want to hear it.
And they'll recognize,
that's good.
Yeah. And they'll recognize that darkness or the spiral that you describe for them. What would your word of advice
well,
be?
My honestly, just remember, it's not a weakness that this debilitating disease. It's not a weakness. It's no different than any other, ailment. It's not a weakness, and it's a sickness, and there's help. And you got to feel like you can talk and get help and go to a doctor or go to a counselor or whatever direction you think you should go. It's not a weakness to have this.
And it's more common than people think.
Oh my, it's amazing how many people. And like I said, my wife's name's Joni, and you know, giving talks, I learned that there's more Jonies out there than Clints, if that makes sense.
Sure.
You might not be the one struggling with mental illness or depression or whatever you want to call it. We should call it mental health. You're struggling with mental health.
Sure.
And there's a lot of people that go, oh yeah, I don't have it, but I have somebody in my life that does. What do you do? Where do you go? How do you live with this person? And that's why I said she's a big part. You know, we kind of hit both sides of the street with her side and mine.
Delicate for sure, but worth it in the end. I know that when you're sick, not weak, it's like it's a T-shirt. That's the number one credo: sick, not weak. And the last thing I was supposed to ask you about the time that you punched Kelly Rudy in the nose.
You know, I don't remember that. That's Kelly's
Kelly's
story. Yeah. Yeah.
Says you give him.
I was a scrappy, kid. And well, right up till, recently, I've always been a, sticking my nose in where it probably didn't belong, just to get in a little tussle. But I don't remember. You know, it's funny, Kelly and I growing up, he's great. Just a great guy. You know, and he blurbed on my book jacket too, and he left me a message after he read the book before it was in print and everything, and I still have the message.
Yeah.
You know, it was so heartfelt and so profane, and the profanity was like just such. We use that, in the hockey, jock talk. We can't talk in a full sentence without using a few cuss words, it seems, but. The emphasis was like, I cannot believe you, the courage. And I kept the message because at a time when, before the book is released, I needed to hear a little reassurance. And, guys like him and Brian Burke and Don Cherry that read the book and commented on it, it was helpful.
Tell us about where you're at now. I know you've got a big ranch in Nevada. This is your happy place?
My wife and I started from scratch with that place, and we did it together. We went through hell together in that place, going through a deep, dark depression for me and rehab and treatment and everything. And it's still our home. It's what we built, and it is a happy place. And that's also where the gunshot incident happened. So, you know, we've overcome, we built it, some things happened, and we feel safe there. It's a little removed from, you know, hockey and the world, but it's not that far removed that we can just jump in whenever we can, whenever we want. But we're happy there for sure. Horses are therapeutic for me.
How's Pumpkin doing? We need a Pumpkin.
Pumpkin.
For those who don't know, who's Pumpkin?
Pumpkin is probably a 100-year-old donkey that an older gentleman keeps this donkey, and he spends every waking moment with this donkey, and you know, they're a sight to watch, the two of them.
Sounds like me and Warner. I wake up early and spend my time with a donkey.
Yeah, exactly.
I relate.
Yeah, I can see that for sure.
Well, I'm glad you're proud, because you should be. This is great work, man. I can only imagine how, like you say, the pain and all that it must have been to go through this, but it is worth it. It's going to help people, and I know that that's job number one with this, and focus number one is helping other people. And I guarantee you there are people listening right now that will be one step closer to going to a doctor, talking to somebody.
Sometimes it's just not feeling alone, like you're weird or different or anything. You're not.
Good for you, man.
Thank you.
Our text line's exploding with reaction. A lot of people just absolutely...
That's because Warner's gone.
Well, it happens too.
They're very happy.
This is very...
This is very happy. Yeah.
But no, in all sincerity, it's a great thing you've done.
Do you guys ever feel sorry for Rhett? Yeah, exactly.
The world's luckiest man. Yeah. That's what Boomer called him yesterday. Yeah,
yeah. His life is a fantasy camp.
Yeah. He's a good guy. He's a great guy. Good character. And we need more of those humorous types. It's fun that you can abuse somebody to that degree, and he just doesn't get it.
Yeah. Yeah, there is that disconnect for sure. The book is called The Great Game. Online bookstores, you can find it wherever you need it.
The Crazy Game.
Or sorry, what did I call it?
What did you
call
it?
The Great Game.
The Crazy Game, sorry.
It's hockey, but The Crazy Game.
The Crazy Game. It's Clint Malarchuk. Great work with Dan Robson, also of Sportsnet. Good on you, man. How are you feeling? How's today?
Awesome. It's busy. A lot of media. We go up to Edmonton for a book signing. We're coming back to Calgary. Yeah, we'll be back here book signing in the 6th of November at Owl's Nest.
Okay. Awesome.
7 o'clock.
Perfect.
Mark it, folks, on the calendar. Yeah.
Well done. Love you, pal. Take
care. All right. Thank you, guys.